You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 23rd of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we high kick stage left as the 1970s Broadway musical A Chorus Line is back. We'll ask critic Donald Tutera whether it's a dream revival.
Also ahead in this week's music review, we'll meet Itamar Shafrir, the man who teams up artists with brands to make commercials. He'll be bringing in a selection of his favourite tracks.
And we'll be previewing an upcoming festival which looks between the lines of documentary filmmaking in a wired world.
We thought that it would be really good to bring these films together, not necessarily premieres, but films that are around this theme, and discuss the issues, discuss what's happening between people who normally don't talk to each other.
All that, plus we'll cross to Naples for a spot of culture too. Lots to look forward to this week here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. Lots to pack into, including an interview in a moment which I suspect is going to be between two giddy geese. Our first guest, Donald Tutera, has already walked in, not wanting to give away too much, but I've already been treated to a little bit of high kick stage left. I've even been shown a poster, would you believe? I have two fans of A Chorus Line sitting in front of me, and we shall approach that in a minute. But before that, Gillian, the cultural week this week has been very much geared towards the Oscars, hasn't it?
Yes, I think that's another thing when it comes to anticipation. I think this year it's been quite a good drum roll because the films, I've seen most of them, but I think they're really good films. It's been a great year for movies, 2012, and they've been films for grown-ups. They're really good films. So I've been interested to watch the coverage and the hijinks that always happens at the last minute. And sadly, I won't be taking my seat in L.A. on Sunday evening, but we'll be waking up to the news.
Shame on the Academy for not.
What did you like?
I made sure I snuck in to see Argo last week because I thought if this is going to be the runaway success of the Oscars, then I'd better go and have a look.
And
I thought it was an excellent film. I thought it was one of those films that you sit down and it ticked every single box in terms of drama and cinematography and acting and plot and perfect balance between comedy, tense, thriller, the works. It was brilliant. And I found myself quite angry at the critics this week who have been almost dismissing Argo as the film that shouldn't win the Oscar but is going to anyway for Best Movie.
Well, they've been picking it apart, saying, oh, it's not true to fact. Well, yeah, but most feature films that are based on fact aren't. Otherwise, they'd make a documentary. So you do take dramatic license with it. And that's almost a given when you see a feature film based on fact.
I heard one critic say, is 2013 going to be the year when everybody looks ahead and says, oh, what was that film that beat Zero Dark Thirty or Lincoln or whatever film? And I actually thought, well, actually, please stop showing so many sour grapes to Argo.
Absolutely.
Because it does offer a really complete piece of cinema to you, which I went in on purpose not knowing anything about it. I decided I was going to do one of those impossible things, which is not read any review about it, not
That's
find out about the
with
plot.
Argo.
Absolutely. I looked away. And as a result, I had a really good, pure cinema experience. And boy, was it fun. And boy, was my heart racing. And boy, were my nails bitten by the end.
And I absolutely adored the way they set the 70s time and mood. And I gather cinematically they did this by blowing up the film to give it a very authentic sort of 70s feel. And also, of course, all the costumes and the wardrobes and the hair and the beards. You know, you really were going back into the 70s.
It was great. And Ben Affleck will be sort of named as the best director who never was nominated. Oh, Academy, you better do it right tomorrow night. The time is just coming up to 9 minutes past the hour. You're listening to The Review. High kick stage left, ladies and gentlemen. because I am indeed surrounded by two giddy geese. As soon as our next guest walked into the studio, I was treated to impromptu dance moves from Mr. Bias, no less, and song and a poster, because we kick off the show this week, quite literally, with a long-awaited revival of a Broadway classic. Dust off your dance shoes, take your positions, and pull on those gold leotards so high-cut they make your eyes water.
With nothing but a thin white line, a wall of mirrors, and a totally unknown cast filling an empty stage, A Chorus Line became an instant smash hit when it first opened in 1975. It's a simple story, eavesdropping on a Broadway audition, but its enduring appeal is down to the epic nature of what it's really about. It's about dreams and about ambitions, and strikes a chord and hits a nerve not just with wannabe singers and dancers, but with anyone who ever really wanted to make something different of their life.
Well, keeping brilliant time to that is Donald Hutera, dance and theatre critic for the Times newspaper. He was at the premiere on Wednesday night. Welcome, Donald. Still on cloud nine?
I am. Hearing that music, it's hard not to get up and dance. And the show made me want to dance at the end, if not during the middle of it.
I think everyone in the theatre was tapping their feet and turning their shoulders to the tune of the music and tipping their imaginary hats.
But what I love about it is how emotional it is and how it shows how merciless the magic can be of show business.
That's a good way to put it.
The two things together, it's so cruel, and in some ways for these hoofers, these Broadway gypsies, who Cassie says, the lead female, she says, it would be nice to be a star, but I'm not. I'm a dancer. And I love that little beat, you know, but I'm not. Wait. I'm a dancer.
It is one of those incredible pieces of work that blew everything apart, 38 years ago when it first hit the stage. And, of course, the way that culture has moved on now, we are now surrounded by media and art forms and television programmes, which are in themselves like the Chorus Line 38 years on. We now watch auditions as part of our cultural diversion. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that Chorus Line hasn't been revived earlier than this? Because it seems perfect.
I'm not sure why it hasn't been revived.
I think people might have thought it was dated. And when they have the intimacy and the voyeurism of cameras that can get deeper and penetrate and become a bit more tabloid, I think they thought no one would be interested in that simple story of a chorus line, which has no bells and whistles and
no stars.
No stars.
Because the entire ensemble is the star.
Absolutely.
I've lost my train of thought. I'm so excited.
Both of us are dumbstruck.
I think what's interesting for
people who don't know really the history of Chorus Line, you know, when it started and they decided that somewhere within the stories of that simple, the unsung heroes in the Chorus Line was a much more epic story.
And it's almost therapeutic.
And they started talking to these dancers,
the
creators, they did taped interviews, just talking to them about why they wanted to dance, why they got into show business, why they endured, what their dreams were. And out of these hours and hours of raw tape came, you know, the story and the lyrics. And I think also, you know, that's also why it strikes a chord, because they're very heartfelt and they're very emotional and they're very revealing. And they don't just apply to anyone, you know, who wanted to go in show business.
Well, it's a timepiece, but it's a timepiece that is still, I don't know, relevant. It's still inspiring.
Yeah.
It's human. It's so human, and the glitz of it is so simple, and a bit raw as well. And I think it works really brilliantly, and the cast is wonderful. And when Victoria Hamilton Barrett sings a song called "Nothing," which is about a Stanislavskian acting class that she just didn't feel whatever she was meant to feel. She felt nothing. she's, you know, it's her star turn. She's terrific, by the way. But many of them are terrific. And as a collective, they're really a wonderful bunch. Now, I've got two tiny criticisms of it. But it's okay to have that. I still love it.
I'm not going to hit you.
it sounds like a good marriage, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. One is that I'm not sure that the final eight who get selected, they're actually pretty imbalanced if you really think about it. If it's all supposed to be uniform, but it doesn't matter.
Imbalanced as people,
well,
human
as people,
beings,
as say, shape, sizes, etc. Just a little bit. That was a tiny little niggling thing.
And is that because of the way that it is cast or inherent to the production itself, given the fact that the characters are all so different?
I'm not sure. I don't know. I actually don't know why. But I was thinking about that afterwards. That I don't think if it was about casting eight people to be in the background supporting the star of a show we never see or don't know except for the song One, then, you know, why would you pick those people? They just, I thought about that afterwards. Mm. But it didn't matter because I loved the ones they picked and I felt sorry for the ones that they didn't pick. You know, I was with them the whole way. The other thing is Cassie's big number is a little lurid, I think.
Really?
Yeah. It just didn't work as well for me. Although Scarlett Strahlen, however you say her name, out of the Strahlen dynasty, she's very good actress.
This is a musical about dancers, and there's actually not that much dance in it. But this, the one scene you're mentioning, is the big epic sort of dance.
Her big solo explosion.
Yeah, exactly. What I like about Chorusine is it makes you think. You know, generally when you think of the Greek chorus and you think of the purpose of a Greek chorus, I mean, it's meant to be completely anonymous. But then it talks about every man, or it gives a funny, revealing point of view about bigger issues. And, you know, not to be too deep about a very glittery musical, but in a way it does make you think of those things.
I think when you look at the documentary, that one of the opening lines when they were trying to listen to the tales of the people who were going to join the chorus line, I think that, you know, someone said, I find you all pretty interesting. And this is one of those things. Is that perhaps what makes it... an enduring success insofar as everybody, when they sit down and watches a chorus line, is at least somebody for a moment who's on that stage.
Exactly. I think that's exactly true.
And someone who generally may be quite anonymous. And I think that's what's interesting is, you know, with choruses, with chorus lines, with the people on the tube you go to work with, there's a lot of anonymity in our life, but everyone, you know, is very special.
Jobbing dancers. Yeah. But it's about the ordinary and the extraordinary. And another thing I really love about it is it's so brilliantly staged, and that big number is used as a kind of quiet juggernaut in the background of the emotional confrontation scene between Cassie, the woman who didn't make it in Hollywood, and Zach, the director of choreography, is her former lover. And they have this scene where they talk about that, and in the background... everybody's doing Singular Sensation silently, and it is like this machine of creation, art, work, Broadway, the career, and what got in the way of the two of them, you know, being an enduring couple.
There is the great show-stopping number at the end, One. Do you think, given the fact that it was written, 38 years ago, and when you look at when you look at the older productions and the fact that this has been reproduced faithfully, do you think it is a musical of its time in terms of the music and the style and the staging of it?
Well, it is of its time, and there are references to, you know, old Hollywood people like
Busby Berkeley,
or Jill St. John and Troy Donahue and all of it. But not so many people have continued to do what Michael Bennett did, which is meld everything, text, movement, you know, no sets. It was such a radical departure, and it was a piece about the theater.
Well, then there's Hello, Dolly. All the big musicals were full of sets and costumes.
And story, but here the story is the people and...
stripped bare.
Yeah, very, very much.
And this is faithful to the original, Jane.
It is. I mean, down to, you know, the outfits that they wear. And in a way, it's very retro. It does feel very 70s. But I love the fact that it is, they haven't felt the need to modernize it.
They don't need to.
Exactly.
Because it still will strike a chord and hit the nerve and do all those things. And it's sort
and
of like...
make you want to dance and
make
sing.
You want to dance. It's, I think it's such... It is a legendary show. And part of it is it's... It's like the way in the show they talk about the red shoes. You know, somebody says, I didn't want to dance because of the red shoes, and, you know, didn't like the red shoes. But the red shoes in the 40s was a film that made people want to be dancers. Michael Jackson made people want to be dancers. And A Chorus Line made people want to enter show business.
And do you think it still will? I mean, it clearly has a profound effect on the two people in front of
me. We're going to Pineapple in about an hour, right?
Ladies and gentlemen, they're dressed for the part as well. What kind of effect do you think that A Chorus Line could now have on a new generation, given the fact that we are surrounded by lots and lots of reality audition shows? Do you think it will still be able to carve a niche in the way that it clearly has done in the past?
It might well do. I mean, I don't see why not. It's so pervasive. But if somebody sees something not on their television screen, but live, the buzz on that first night, and granted, first nights are usually full of buzz because everybody's there loving everything before we're even out of the gate. But the buzz was so palpable. It was exciting. I felt so uplifted and moved and touched. And it was a communal experience. It was a live communal experience, which is why we go to the theater. And it doesn't happen to this degree often.
But that's why I think it's interesting, because the first night audience is often the most cynical. They've seen it all before. You know, they're going to judge something that's back. Is it as great as everyone says it is? Is it not? So to get a first night audience on its feet and cheering, I think does say a lot.
I was really surprised in this, you know, this what you call the poster. It's I tore it out of, you know, one of the free papers in London.
What have you brought in for us, Donna? You were flapping
show
it
and
around.
Tell. It says, show and tell.
Triumphant, sizzling and extraordinary, showbiz heaven, timeless and thrilling. They're all four stars. They're all four-star shows, and I hate the star rating system, but I would have given it 5.
Me
absolutely.
Too.
And
I'm biased.
I haven't done that in, you know, 2 or 3 years in my reviewing.
Donald Tutera, thank you very much indeed for joining us. I'm sorry to cut you short. I'm sure you'll be...
We could go on for hours, Gillian and I.
Donald will be silently high-kicking at the back of the studio until we come off air, no doubt. Donald Tutera, dance and theatre critic for The Times. Thank you very much, as ever, for joining us here on The Review today. And A Chorus Line runs until January the 18th, 2014 at the London Palladium, so there's plenty of time to see it for yourself if you're in the city this year. And if you're Gillian, she'll be booking her weekly seat. Stay tuned, because next we'll be taking a little cultural journey around the world to whet your appetite for the weekend. Stay with us.
On Monocle's Culture Show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed, intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson. Next, we'll be indulging in a spot of music, but first, it's time to cross to Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, for her weekly roundup of cultural treats this weekend from around the world.
It It is freezing in Montreal this weekend, but fine wine and hot food is enough to make you forget about the chilly weather. The annual festival, Montréal en Lumière, combines outdoor activities, fine dining and cultural events to shine the spotlight on this cold Canadian city. The festival is at various locations across Montreal until the 3rd of March. This weekend, we have two film offerings on our agenda. For the cinema goers, we recommend I Wish, the latest feature by Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. It is a well-acted, sympathetic portrayal of three generations of the fractured Osako family. I Wish is now at cinemas across the UK. And for those who prefer the comfort of their homes, we suggest the re-release of The Last Days of Dolwyn. Directed by Emlyn Williams back in 1949, this classic film is now remastered by Studio Canal and available to buy on DVD. If you find yourself in Tokyo this weekend, be sure to catch online gallery Valerie Mallory's exhibition before it vanishes back into the virtual world. The online venture has found a temporary home in Tokyo's Common Gallery, in Harajuku's trendy Cat Street. The exhibition features the works of an eclectic group of up-and-coming artists from London, New York, Los Angeles and beyond, including Danny Sangra, Andrew DeFrancesco and Christy Abbott, to name a few. Dreamy, bizarre and at times outrageous, the show ends this Sunday. Finally on our playlist this weekend is the new music collaboration by British indie guitar player Lloyd Cole and German electronic music master Hans-Joachim Rodelius. Selected Studies Volume 1 is available to buy now. Let's hear Pastoral. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And that was Lloyd Cole and Hans-Joachim Rodelius with Pastoral. The album Selected Studies Volume 1 is out now. And that ends that report there from Nelly Gocheva. Now it's time on the review for our weekly music review. Centuries ago, our next guest would perhaps have been an alchemist. Such is the magic when the right song meets the right brand and the ensuing commercial can take a simple product and transform its image forever. I'm delighted to say that our guest today is Itamar Shafrir, who is creative manager for games and advertising at Universal Publishing.
Itamar works in the exclusive and elusive art of music consultancy, finding the perfect track to sync to an advert, and has been behind some of the biggest and most iconic TV campaigns here in the UK, making stars out of obscure artists and one well-placed song. Welcome to the review, Itamar.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
We're delighted, and I'm very curious first to hear from you how you ended up to come to this specialty.
Well, to be honest with you, I started working in music when I was out of the army. I left to kind of like find my luck in New York, like a lot of the Israelis do, and I ended up working in a music company. I was quite lucky to be
ended up just like that.
I tend to be in the right place in the right time. I won't lie to you. There's a lot of luck factor in it. I did a short internship there and worked illegally. For a few months.
If you whisper, it doesn't matter. This is radio.
And I think kind of like that's where it started. Then I went back to Israel. I did a little bit of radio. Actually, I had a radio, a couple of radio shows, DJing, and then I was running a music consultancy department in a clearance house in Israel. So basically, it's been choosing music for people most of my life, and then moved to London because I, it felt to me that this is the place where, you know, all the trendsetters sit and decide for the rest of the world what's, you know, what's the next big thing and what's relevant and what's, you know, for me, the best music in the world always came out of the UK.
I've always found it an astonishingly interesting world of how you marry a great piece of music to a great brand. And you obviously do that every single day of your life. How do you go about doing that?
First of all, I enjoy it. I enjoy it really, really dearly. And I deal with a lot of type of brands. Some of them are, let's say, less sexy than others. You know, a lot of supermarket chains, a lot of kind of like dog foods and hygiene products and stuff like that, which I specifically love the most because it's a bigger challenge. First of all, you need to.
And how do you make a hygiene brand?
Look,
how do you make me sound drop like my cornflakes? I'm looking, going, I must go and buy that particular hygiene brand.
I'll be honest with you. It all usually boils down to a few keywords that are always after. So it's all. So if it's a hygiene product, it will be freedom and happiness and some sort of empowerment. And it's but you know, the biggest challenge for me is to find the artist that will agree to license their music to this sort of.
I mean,
brand.
We're laughing about it, but it's an incredibly important thing that you're having to do. And you know, how do you circumvent the fact that we were having a bit of a giggle of it, and then you have to go and persuade an artist that really you should be allying yourself to this product?
Yeah, I mean, look, and in today's reality, where people are selling less records than ever, I think a lot of the artists realize that, you know, in order to kind of like to maintain in people's minds, they need to license their catalog and they need to, you know, get their name out there. Sometimes they care less about the product and they just want to be marketed to a certain target market. And, you know, if you take big bands, I think like Queen, that, you know, that have licensed the music to a lot of, you know, ads and a lot of campaigns, whether you like it or not, you know, it kind of like keeps it an timeless type of band.
What is an example of an ad where a song has really, really, you know, made a difference?
I think quite recently, a few months ago, we've licensed one of Alex Clare's song to an Internet Explorer ad. And it just, his record sale has rocketed in hundreds of percent. And he actually broke the American market, which is, you know, every up-and-coming artist kind of like dream, and he did it big time, and he actually got a big record deal on the back of that, and he's became quite massive. I think they just made the right choice. They had a really nice creative. The ad looked really good. The song looked really fitted really well with the visuals, and the rest is history. I mean, millions of views, links to iTunes, and you know, Bob's your uncle.
You mentioned Alex Clare being an up-and-coming artist. The first person who you have chosen to play to us today is also an up-and-coming young lady, Universal's most promising name, you say?
Yeah, Laura Mavula.
Yes.
She is one of our recent signings. She's going to be supporting Paloma Faith in a few months, the O2, so you can understand that type of direction that she's going. A lot of soulful new jazz, I think with some African influences, and really nice, clean vocals and productions. And I think this is kind of like where the music is going today as well. So I'm guessing she's going to get big one day. I'm hoping at least.
We'll talk a little bit more about her in a moment. This is her track, Green Garden. As a tree tall, down again, putting my bag down, taking my shoes off, walking the carpet, a green velvet.
But it's okay now, bathing the sunlight.
And that was Laura Mavula there and her track Green Garden, the first choice of our music review guest this week, Itamar Shafrir, who's creative manager for games and advertising at Universal Publishing, the man who makes music and adverts and brands work beautifully together. Just listening to that, I suddenly heard it and thought that would make a beautiful piece of music for an advert. Is there a kind of piece of music that is naturally sympathetic to advertising?
Yes. I mean, look, there's a lot of quite standard briefs that come from brands, and in most cases, if it's something, you know, if it's again, you know, a supermarket chain or something that is not super cool or electronic-y, or, you know, that they're not trying too hard, they'll usually want something that is quite warm in sound, that has a nice build to it, which this song has. They love hand clapping, so that will always be a good selling point. A bit of whistle, and just a really nice kind of like uplifting feel to it.
But I guess sometimes you just have to be very brave and daring. I mean, I just think a brilliant choice was the Virgin ads when they used, was it Michael Bublé, Dreams Flying High? And just, I mean, instantly made me want to fly Virgin. It just, and the cinematic potential of that. But you might not immediately think, oh, I hear an ad. But I think, you know, you have to be quite brave.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, I think, you know, like, for example, placing the Smiths for a John Lewis ad, which I've done in the past, and I may have gained some enemies.
We mentioned this before we came on air, that the fact that I took personal umbrage to the fact that the Smith song was being used.
Yeah.
But it opened up the interesting question as to what point is music sacred, and certain bits of music that you won't put forward for an advert because they're too personal to you.
Yes, I mean, there are a few of the bands that I grew up on that are signed to Universal, and I it's just really hard for me to put them forward, and which is, I think, kind of a double standard, because this is what I do to other people. But I mean, if you find the right fit, I think that for every ad there is a song, and there's no need to try and shoehorn a heritage artist that has done, you know, has contributed a lot to the industry, and to put them in a, you know, again, sorry for giving, you know, for but like a dog food ad or something like that. Mm. I think that, for example, the Smith's choice for John Lewis was actually it's an ad that won awards, and I think
it did a lot for John Lewis sales.
Yeah, and look, I think they do it every year. I think that all I saw when I had a look at the lyrics of the song was they were talking about someone that just wants to get something, which is that kind of like Christmas feel, and I thought all the people are going to relate to it, and I think the fact that it was actually re-recorded and they didn't use the original Smith's version makes it a bit, maybe, I don't know, makes me sleep better at night.
It softened it slightly.
Yeah,
it did ease the pain ever so slightly. Let's move on to your second choice.
Sorry.
She says through gritted teeth.
It's fine, I've sort of forgiven you. Yeah. A man from Los Angeles, a keyboardist, Jason Joseph, who's he?
All right. I don't know much about Joseph. I chose this cover version to kind of like, in the world of advertising, it's a lot about giving the brand a, you know, making the song their own. So a lot of the brands like to re-record a song and to kind of like give it a completely different feel from the original recording. And I think this song kind of like gives it a good example. So taking MGMT's kind of like really hard-ish electro production and making it quite funky just gives the song a completely different feel, and it's just a really cool cover.
Let's have a listen. This is Jason Joseph and Electric Feel.
All along the eastern shore, put your circuits in the sea. This is what the world is for, making electricity. You can feel change the world. This is my electric girl.
That was Jason Joseph there and Electric Feel, the choice of Itamar Shafriel, Creative Manager for Games and Advertising at Universal Publishing, and today's music review guest on The Review. Just listening to that, I was wondering when you ever switch off from your musical advertising creative brain and then actually just go out and switch off and enjoy music for itself.
I don't. I can't. I really can't. Really. I mean, whenever I hear a song, it's automatically being placed somewhere in my head. And it's a bit annoying, to be honest with you. I'm trying to remember. I think maybe when listening to music that I grew up on, again, to the you know, your Nirvanas and stuff, that kind of like, you know, all of my teenage idols, I don't make this connection. But, you know, now that this is what I do every day, it's kind of like just there constantly.
Since you put that hat on.
I'm curious about the economics of this. Like, how much roughly does it cost? What are the to license a song for an ad?
It can be anything from a few hundreds of pounds if it's a small online campaign and millions to a global campaign. It's gonna it depends on the media. It depends on the territory, and obviously most of everything it depends on the song itself. Yeah, and a lot of people. Sometimes do the re-record to kind of like save some money, and then, you know, you don't have to pay. You can pay less to the an artist which is not the original one. Yeah.
Itamar, let's move on to your final choice. It is James Blake, his latest single, the first single of his second album. He absolutely exploded on the scene a couple of years ago. Very critically acclaimed album. Now that difficult second album. What's this track like?
This is the new, like you mentioned, the new track. I think the second album is going to be an exact continuation of where the first one kind of like left us. I think he has he's just stepped up his game, and I'm unfortunately I can't play other tracks, but I have a good feeling this is a strong contender for the album of the year, and I feel very lucky to work with someone that I also kind of like, you know, look up to.
Well, thank you very much indeed for coming in. That was Itamar Shafriel, who's Creative Manager for Games and Advertising at Universal Publishing. And yes, I have forgiven you for John Lewis. Yeah. It did work. It worked.
Last time, I promise.
It made us all remember it. So job well done, yeah. Mr. Shafriel.
Thank you, guys.
This is his final choice. It is James Blake, his latest single, Retrograde.
So be the girl you loved. Be the girl you always. So show me why you're strong. Ignore everybody else. We're alone now. Always. So show me why you're strong. Ignore everybody else. We're alone now. Suddenly I'm hit. This darkness of the dawn, and your friends are gone.
And that was James Blake there, and the track was called Retrograde.
It was. Time now for our weekly cultural guide. And this week, we're crossing to Naples to hear what's happening over there in the coming days. Monocle's David Pleasance was there recently, and here's now his guide to the city.
Probably the best way to spend your Saturday in Naples is to take a long seaside passeggiata along the Via Partenope and then up to the Piazza del Plebiscito, taking in the views of Vesuvius along the way. But there's plenty to see indoors, as this, one of Italy's cultural capitals, gets geared up for spring. Naples is famous for its songs, so make sure to catch a performance of La Finta Parigina by seldom-heard Neapolitan composer Domenico Cimarosa. This opera is playing at the charming Teatro Trianon this weekend only. It's also the last chance you can see the wonderful spaces of Pan, the Palazzo delle Arti di Napoli, filled with the thought-provoking works of José María Cano, contemporary artist and former member of Spanish new wave pop sensation Mecano. The show, Arrivederci Capitalismo, Goodbye Capitalism, plays on the imagery and irony of financial journalism. Naples has a long cinematic tradition, and well worth a visit is the annual Festival of Documentary Filmmaking, showing every Friday at the Astra, a mecca for the Neapolitan art house cinema crowd, until May. Highlights include contributions from rising American docu-star Alex Gibney and the fascinating true story of the Football World Cup that was held in Patagonia in 1942 by directors Filippo Macellini and Lorenzo Garzella.
What was the Rimae Cup doing in Patagonia in 1942? What teams took part in that tournament played in such a distant and far away place? Why has no one ever said anything about it?
And finally, more music, although slightly more recent this time, from legendary Franco Battiato, the Sicilian-born singer-songwriter who shot to fame in the 1980s with a string of chart-topping pop songs. His song Alexanderplatz became Italy's musical tribute to the Cold War and became a hit in Germany and the USSR. You can hear Battiato bashing out his melodies at the Teatro Augusteo.
Sai che d'inverno si vive bene come di primavera. Sì, sì, proprio così. La bidella ritornava dalla scuola un po' più presto.
David Pleasant there ending that report of his last great visit to Naples. I think that man interviewed everybody in Naples. He did a really, really interesting week-long series on the forthcoming elections here in Italy this weekend. And he managed to have time to squeeze in that little cultural snippet. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment to hear about an upcoming festival seeking to reflect the changing nature of the documentary.
At 1800 hours London time, tune in to Midori House, the hour-long show that lifts the lid on the daily workings at Monocle's HQ. We delve deeper into the stories of the latest issue of Monocle and catch up with our editors and correspondents on the road as they put together the next one. Tune in at 1800 hours London time and finish the working day with Midori House, live every weekday.
And welcome back to the studio. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with Jolene Tobias and Emma Nelson. Now, seeing documentaries in cinemas is becoming more and more popular. And in the new media landscape, the way these documentaries are financed, made and distributed is ever changing.
Next weekend in London, the Between the Lines three-day festival, produced in collaboration with that hideout for the foreign correspondent, the Frontline Club, explores the challenges facing documentary makers and debate on the issues and opportunities raised by things like the internet, transmedia and merging documentary conventions. To hear more, Gillian spoke to the festival's director, Elizabeth Wood.
Basically, it's about the fact that documentary is the way we find out about the world. And traditionally, you've watched that on television, you've seen films on, well, now on More4 and BBC4. But we wanted to look at the fact that this is a very, very potent, strange, changing time. Not just because of the internet, but also because of what's happening to those institutions, the broadcast institutions, whereby traditionally the audience got their information about the world. And without documentary, how do you find out about what's going on in the world, whether that is documenting on the news or on current affairs, or independent voices of creative documentary makers?
So when you say between the lines, when it comes to filmmaking, what to you in this festival does that mean?
It means that actually with user-generated footage and citizen journalism, the news is now using clips, especially in war zones, that are generated by individuals and are put online. That what was the traditional documentary world, as I think Robert Redford said at Sundance a couple of years ago, investigative reporting is now the new documentary. And that's quite an interesting idea.
But isn't there a difference between investigative reporting and user-generated reporting? Because anyone can put an iPhone somewhere, but that doesn't necessarily make them an investigative journalist.
Absolutely. And that is what is between the lines. Mm. So if you traditionally define, it's a very exciting time, actually. Mm. If you traditionally defined a news reporter, like Lindsay Hilson on Channel 4, or an investigative reporter on Dispatches or Panorama, or an independent documentary maker who was essentially giving their creative view and their insight into the world, then those were very clearly defined lines. Mm.
Comes with credentials, so there is a very grey area in terms of journalism.
Well, that's what's interesting, and that's what the weekend is all about. What's happening with those merging lines? What's happening when corporate influence even is affecting the news, like Fox News and Mr. Murdoch? What's happening on Newsnight when something very strange went on at the BBC? All those things are affecting the audience. Mm-hmm. And the audience traditionally has thought that they're seeing the truth. And now they're starting to question that. And one of the reasons they're doing that is because they're not quite sure about these merging boundaries. And so we wanted to have a weekend where we could get innovative people like William Muricchio, who is the head of the MIT Open Documentary Lab, traditional documentary makers like Kevin MacDonald, and Dorothy Byrne, who is head of current affairs, dispatchers at Channel 4, and get them all together to discuss what they believe is really happening and what the future is for these exploding forms, really.
It's interesting because your festival isn't for necessarily industry figures or documentary filmmakers. It's for members of the public. So do you sense that the public really are hungering for fact rather than just fiction? And so this is, you know, of interest for them to be able to be part of that discussion.
That's absolutely a major focus of the festival. It is for the public, some of whom have now become the producers, of course. So that's a very interesting merging line. And, you know, you can go out and film your own version of what's happened at some demonstration, and it can be up and open for anyone in the world to see within 5 minutes. And in the case of the Arab Revolution, that was hugely effective. So lots of innovative things are happening, and we just felt that it was a really good time to open it all up, not be prescriptive and definitive, but say, look, these are the issues, let's discuss them openly. And especially for the people who watch and listen. And
so let's look a little bit at the programme of films that are going to be addressing this. And perhaps you can highlight a film that really looks at this issue and then how you'll be discussing it afterwards.
Well, I don't think there's one film that looks at all the issues. If you look at our programme, we have 7 spine sessions with panels of 4 people. And we hope that there's a kind of narrative to that, that we're going to start with what's happening for corporate and political interests and on broadcast channels. And then we're going to talk about where that leaves the traditional documentary maker and what opportunities there are for them in the future. Then we're going to talk about what we call the grassroots surge, which is people using generated footage and experimental ideas, online crossovers. And then on the Sunday, we're going to look at how this affects storytelling, because, of course, most documentary is about telling stories, whether it's a 4-minute slot on the news or it's an hour and a half documentary at the Sundance Festival. And so how is storytelling affected by makers who are saying, well, actually, we want to make this interactive. We want the public to be able to choose their story. So that's the sort of final session. But then as these sessions are offered, we also have in another cinema 8 films for the public and some that are only for our delegates. And that's only because we don't have enough cinema time. We've got to make up a little cinema. And the idea is that if you go and see those films, you'll see a cross-section of the kind of films that are raising these issues, like Zero Silence, which is about how the Tunisian Revolution and then the Egyptian Revolution actually perhaps couldn't have happened without the mobile phone and the internet.
Let's have a listen now to that clip, and then you can talk to us a little bit more about the filmmakers.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day. Millions of words to report the world in newspapers.
Who made this film and how did it come to be packaged as a documentary as we know it?
Well, it was made by Independence. Johnny von Wallström was one of the makers. There are 3 makers, Javinia Kabani and Alexandra Sandals. They got together and by going to these places over a period of time, interviewing the people who were there before the Arab uprising, what happened during it, and what the result is. And so it's a really interesting documentary about what's actually happened over that period by the people who were actually involved in it and doing it, and including lots of footage that was shot at that time.
When it comes to investigative documentary making, is there one country that is really strong at this at the moment?
perhaps that the Sundance Festival and the Americans have really pushed this element of we've got to remember documentary is a very broad subject. But in terms of this kind of almost fashion, if you like, this lately, the rise of the investigative documentary is one of the things that we really need to talk about. And I think, you know, Eugene Jarecki has been making documentaries for a long time, but he's just made The House I Live In, which is a brilliant questioning of the drug laws in America. Central Park Five is another one of about five, I think, that came out of America last year, which is revisiting misjustices in the legal system in the States. That's quite a lot of docs, actually, to be around that theme. I mean, even Werner Herzog has made a film in America about a young guy on death row and the justice system.
One of the other films you've highlighted is The House We Live In. How does that fit in the Between the Lines theme?
As I mentioned, it's Eugene Jarecki. He's an incredibly respected documentary maker. All his documentaries, he made a wonderful expose of Henry Kissinger years ago. He's perhaps one of the two leading, let's call, investigative documentary makers, which is emerging line. The other person is, of course, Alex Gibney, who's just made Mea Maxima Culpa, which we're also going to show. I think what's interesting is that actually The House I Live In is presented as a personal journey. It starts with him talking about his own circumstances and then goes on to make some really extraordinary claims about the drug laws in America and how they're actually related to racial persecution, if you like.
I say he's a criminal.
Let him go to prison.
I have a life and 30-year sentence.
20 years for drug trafficking.
I have life without parole for 3 ounces of methamphetamine.
Of the 2,600 people I've sent to federal prison, I've seen three or four kingpins. We're incarcerated poor people who are drug addicts.
You're watching poor, uneducated people be fed into a machine like meat to make sausage.
And for these filmmakers, how important is the festival circuit? Festivals like yours, they're the big festivals, and probing festivals like the one you're curating over this course of this weekend.
Well, our festival's a little unique in that it's not, in strictest terms, a festival like the Sundance Festival, which is just about showing films across a broad, excellent films, new films, premier films across a broad range, or the Sheffield Documentary Festival, which is the same, or the most famous documentary festival, only documentary festival, is the Amsterdam International Documentary Festival. Ours is focused on an issue, so it's a different kind of festival. We thought it was very useful to do that, because often you go to a festival, you see an interesting film, you get a Q&A with someone, 20 minutes, it's over. Mm. And we thought that it would be really good to bring these films together, not necessarily premieres, but films that are around this theme, and discuss the issues, discuss what's happening between people who normally don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. It's very rare for someone who's talking about multi-platform, non-linear storytelling to be on the same panel as someone who's funding films and traditional documentaries that work on the festival circuit. The festival circuit has become increasingly important as a platform for showing your documentary, as really it's been marginalized on the broadcast channels. Where do you show this? And what you hope to do is that you show your film at a festival, and then a distributor, and there are more and more of those, pick them up and give
have
them a
the
run in the cinema.
To run with it, yeah.
And of course, that couldn't have happened without the digital revolution. Because one of the problems with documentary was that you couldn't really get into the cinema circuit because you couldn't afford the print costs. You know, to distribute a film 20 years ago cost a fortune. You had to get all these prints to go to all these cinemas. And now with digital projectors, etc., you can do that very cheaply. And so that is good for everyone. So distributors like Dogwoof, who does a lot of things that we work with, are actually becoming an area where the independent international documentary can get a chance to be seen by the audience, which is what it's all about. And, of course, The House I Live In, we've got to remember, was actually funded by Nick Fraser at BBC Storyville. And that's very interesting because I think more people know about The House I Live In because of its cinema distribution than the fact that it was on BBC4.
And that was Elizabeth Wood, director of the Between the Lines Festival. You can see it from this coming Friday, the 1st of March, here at Rich Mix Cinema in East London. It runs until Sunday the 3rd. If you're not in London, however, next weekend, just visit betweenthelinesfest.com for more details. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review for today. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our thanks to our producer, Katie Bilboa, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Ed Lucas, too. Our studio manager was Alex Funnell.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the Weekend Edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget that, as ever, the Monocle Weekly is on air on Sunday at midday London time with Steve Bloomfield and Andrew Tuck.
Meanwhile, you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson,
and Julian Tobias.
Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.